You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
It was over 25,000 years before the Battle of Yavin, on the now-abandoned planet of Tython. Once teeming with life, civilization, and the Force, this planet was the birthplace of the Jedi and the setting of a story for the ages. It was an era when hyperspace travel was in its infancy, and few species had been able to travel beyond their native star systems. This was especially true for the people of the Tython system, which was already a burgeoning society in its own right. It contained all the trappings of what you would see only in an advanced civilization. Interplanetary commerce, science, technology, civil institutions, and a broad range of sentient species. One thing they lacked, however, was hyperspace travel. This is where the Rakata Infinite Empire enters the story. Bent on galactic conquest and possessed by the dark side, the Rakata are drawn to the Tython system because of the unusually strong presence of the Force on the planet of Tython, which shares the system's namesake. When the Rakata arrived, they sent a reconnaissance ship to the planet, and through a series of unfortunate events, there was a crash landing. This crash, and the combination of the dark side presence that accompanied the pilot of the ship, seemed to spark a very dangerous, planet-threatening force storm. It was this storm, along with the arrival of the Infinite Empire, which sparked what would later be dubbed the Force Wars. Not to be confused with the Great Force Wars, which occurred much later. During this era, more than 700 years before the Galactic Republic would be established, there existed a precursor to the Jedi, called the Jedi. Though they shared some similarities to the Jedi Order, they did have some distinct characteristics that separated them. The primary one being their Trinitarian view of the Force. They saw the Force as having three integral characteristics, which made it whole, and without one, it was perverted. The first characteristic was Ashla, which means light. The second was Bogan, which means dark. And the third was Bendu, which means balance. In fact, the planet of Tython had two moons named after these concepts, Ashla and Bogan, which they viewed as symbolic representations of the nature of the Force. The Jedi seem to have derived their doctrines based on observations of the natural world. As the Force-rich Tython would be thrown into vicious storms whenever the Force was thrown out of balance, maintaining equilibrium between the light and the dark side was a matter of life and death.
Observing the world around them, they saw two moons in the one sky, light, Ashla, and dark, Bogan, and they understood the dual aspects to the Force, light and dark. The light defined the dark as the dark did the light. When balance was not maintained, Tython reacted to the imbalance with severe storms and quakes. And so the travelers define themselves, ever seeking a balance, They became the Jedi, a Daibendu term meaning mystic center. Only through the harmony of balance could the Jedi maintain a peaceful world.
Quote from Jedi Temple Master Ketu. One cannot fully appreciate the history of the Republic or the Jedi Order without understanding the context and the people who set in motion a series of events which would alter the fate of countless species and civilizations. It is in the backdrop of a pre-hyperspace civilization that we are introduced to a whole new cast of characters, both heroes, villains, and everything in between, who would become instrumental in shaping the course of an entire galaxy for millennia to come. Zesh, the Force Hound.
The Infinite Empire, though not the first to use slave labor, definitely turned it into an art form. Their favorite type of slaves were Force Adepts, who could be taught to wield the dark side in the service of the Empire. The Rakata called these Adepts Hounds, and they would be employed to carry out bodyguard duties, assassinations, spying, scouting, and an array of other military operations. Among the top tier of these hounds was a human male by the name of Zesh. This particular hound had a dark features and was branded with his name on his face. He had a long and storied career in the service of the Rakatan Praetor, Tulkar, whom he helped to discover and conquer a myriad of small-scale civilizations across the galaxy. Zesh's friend and fellow Force Hound, Trill, was exceptionally gifted at using the Force to discover these planets, and she is credited with the discovery of the planet Tython for the Infinite Empire. Once Tulkar had arrived at the Jedi homeworld with his hound, Zesh, was approached by another Praetor, Skalnas, and was turned into his unwilling ally, helping Skalnas to consolidate his power and position within the Empire. Zesh managed to sabotage Tulkar's ship, the Devourer, and demolish it above the skies of Tython, igniting a powerful force storm and killing his master, the Hound himself just barely escaping to the surface in an escape pod. Once he had landed, he was confronted by a number of Jedi, who eventually subdued him and placed him under arrest on the moon of Bogan, so that he could meditate upon the opposite moon, Ashla, to see the error of his dark ways. Here he encounters the mad Dagon Locke, a wayward Jedi knight, and who is also banished to the moon, and is convinced by Dagon to help him construct a Force Saber, a precursor to the lightsaber designed by the Rakata, which can only be activated through the Force. Eventually, Zesh and Dagon leave the planet and join the fight against the Infinite Empire, where Zesh ultimately kills Skalnas, drives the Rakata out of the Tython system, and reveals his true name, Tau, which means soul.
Trill, the Planet Finder. Prior to the discovery of Tython, the once friend turned rival of Zesh, Trill was a human force hound in the service of Skalnas. Though she was not the skilled fighter that Zesh was, her ability to reach out and find force-rich planets made her an invaluable asset to the Infinite Empire. When it was discovered that Zesh could not be found after the destruction of the Devourer, Trill was commissioned by Skalnas to find him on Tython. While searching, she happened to rescue a Jedi in the jaws of death, who went by the name of Sekhnos Wrath. Certain to hide her identity from the Jedi, she posed as a thief and a nobody, hoping no one would ascertain her true identity. She joins with Sekhnos and his companions in their hunt for Zesh, eventually finding him and informing the Rakata that he is indeed still alive. During the year-long invasion of the Tython system, Trill remains planetside as an informant for the Infinite Empire, eventually betraying her Jedi allies and turning Zesh over to Skalnas. After returning to her Praetor, she was enlisted to lead an army back to the planet, where she had a confrontation with her former friend, Sekhnos Wrath, and was slain by his hand. Dagon Lock the Mad.
He was a charismatic, if not eccentric, Jedi Master who had a pivotal role in ending the Despot War. His actions in the war made him something of a folk hero. He was celebrated and revered by Tithonian society, but this also made him prideful. This overconfidence led Dagon to explore the depths of what was called the Chasm on the surface of Tython. This large cave system was known to have intense force activity and was generally avoided for fear of the drastic effects it would have on those who entered. With his best friend, fellow Jedi, Hawk Ryo, he descended into the Chasm, where they would both share a vision of the coming onslaught of galactic foreigners armed with fire blades, decimating the armies of Tython. Ryo, however, snapped out of his trance and pulled he and Locke out of the Chasm, but the hero of the Despot War was fundamentally changed by his vision and driven mad. When the two had reported to the Council the series of events, Dagon warned them of the vision he had and that an enemy was on its way to their system and would bring Armageddon. When he looked to Ryo to confirm the vision, his closest friend lied and said he had no such vision, pushing Locke further into the dark side and insanity. Because of this, he was banished to Bogan, so that he could meditate on Ashla and regain his balance in the Force, but to no avail. After years of banishment on the moon, he was introduced to Zesh, where they both forged an alliance, and together escaped the moon and began to raise an underground resistance to the Rakata, as well as build an arsenal of Force Sabers. Locke's victories were short-lived, however, when he was eventually recaptured and returned to Bogan, but that would not last long, as the Jedi were caught off guard by the arrival of the Infinite Empire, and thus released Locke to serve as a general in the army. This decision would turn out to be the right one. As crazy as Locke was, he was the perfect person to lead the fight against the onslaught of the Rakata, and was eventually successful in driving them out of the system.
Shay Coda, the Ranger.
When a ranger comes calling, trouble quickly follows.
Quote, Trey Sana. After becoming an orphan at the final battle of the Despot War, where both her parents were slain, Shay Coda would commit her life and service to the Jedi Order. She started as a Padawan, became a journeyer, and finally a ranger, carrying out missions for the Order and being a public face of the Jedi. Though she was mostly human, she is descended from the people of Dathomir and learned the ways of the Force under Master Quan Zhang at the Temple of Science, called Anil Kesh, Here, Shay and her master designed a pet rancor dragon through the use of force alchemy, a practice that would later be banned by the Jedi Order. Coda was one of the rangers who was commissioned to investigate the crash on Tython, in an attempt to discover the cause of violent force storms on the surface. Here, she and her companions first found Zesh, and during the violent encounter, ended up having their force swords cut to shreds by the Hound's superior, Force Saber. Though their first encounter was less than amiable, Zesh and Coda would eventually build a romantic relationship, and she was instrumental in keeping Zesh from being entirely consumed by the dark side. Thanks for flying with us. Jordan here. Just wanted to let everyone know what's happening here at the Star Lores podcast. Star Lores is now on Discord. If you would like to join the Star Lores Cantina Discord server, you can find a link in the description or on any of our social media accounts. Reach out with a DM or email. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching the Star Lores podcast. Go ahead and give our page a like and send us a message. You can also email at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your fan art, Star Wars collections, or fan fictions, and you may even get a feature on one of our pages or even the show. Don't be afraid to offer corrections or add to any of the topics that we discuss on the show. We are also on Patreon, so if you want to help us pay the bills, as well as get a few awesome perks like bonus episodes, access to the private Facebook group, or the VIP section of the Discord server, head on over to patreon.com/StarLores and sign up for as little as $1 a month. And finally, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher app or YouTube, as well as sending us a 5-star review on iTunes. This really helps us reach a wider audience. Enjoy the rest of the show. Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. This is Jordan.
And this is Christian.
Welcome back to the Star Lores podcast, everyone. Today, we are talking about the Jedi Order and the Force Wars. I also just want to remind everyone, we actually have broached this topic in the past on a Patreon exclusive episode where we review the Dawn of the Jedi comic book series. So if you want to listen to that, become a patron and you will get to hear kind of the main plot points of the story. But we'll also get into that here. But anyways, as you heard, we've already sort of covered some of the most important characters in the story. And also these characters are sort of like explain a little bit how they possibly led to sort of the establishment of the Jedi Order and the Republic and stuff like that. But I also wanted to make some honorable mentions of some characters we didn't do a deep profile of. The first one being Sekhnos Wrath, and he was actually from the Sith species, and he was a Jedi journeyer who kills Trill, but he ultimately succumbs to the dark side, which actually seems to happen to a lot of the Jedi in Dawn of the Jedi. And then our next honorable mention is
Hawk Ryo, the male Twi'lek, who was Dagon Locke's best friend, who betrays him after lying to the Jedi Council and sealing Locke out.
Yeah. Again, another... he's a pretty important character in this story, and also sort of ensures that Dagon Locke is, like, fully committed to the dark side. However, in the end, I will say what's kind of interesting is that once the Infinite Empire actually invades the Tython system, the Jedi sort of like are scrambling and they don't know what to do. So they release Locke out of prison, and then they start believing him in his visions because they were all confirmed, right? And so they make him like the leader of the army. And actually, one thing a lot of people might miss when reading the story, it seems like Zesh is sort of the main hero, the hero's journey, right? The transformation, all that. And then Dagon Locke is almost like the guide in the hero's journey. However, in a weird way, it's almost inverse, because Dagon Locke actually saves the system.
Like, yeah, he's the primary hero.
Yeah, he actually leads the fight against the Rakata Infinite Empire. But he becomes totally committed to the dark side, and is like making dark side disciples, right? And you have to remember that, like, the Jedi don't have the same conceptions of like the dark side and the light side that we have. They believe the dark side can be used as like a tool, but it should always be brought back into balance, right? Yeah. And that's like their big thing.
Well, I was just going to say, like, the whole purpose of this book almost breaks the reader's conceptions of light and dark, because you have Hawk Ryo, who, is a Jedi in your mind, right? He's supposed to be light side and acting good,
right?
But he throws his buddy under the bus and lies, right?
Yeah.
So that's getting a little dirt on the Jedi, and then making a Sith the hero puts a little goodness on the Sith, right?
Yeah.
So even in the throughout the story, they're kind of blurring those lines of, like,
absolutely,
Sith aren't all bad and Jedi aren't all good, right?
I think I said this when we reviewed the comic books as well. Like, I think it conceptually, it's actually a super interesting book. You know, I don't care much for a lot of the characters or even the story.
They don't make you like that personally invested in their personal stories and lives as characters. They become almost like icons for like a narrative.
Exactly. But in some ways, the book is almost like meant to be mythological. I think that because it's so old and it's so different from the Star Wars that we know, and like the modern era of Star Wars, that it's like, and that is, you, when you are reading the book, even with like the aesthetic to you know, the conception, certain concepts, like, it is very, you don't feel like you're in the same era as you know, the Battle of Yavin or whatever.
Yeah, and even when they're not like aliens that you immediately identify, like, oh yeah, that's a Twi'lek or that's a Rancor even, and even the Rakata that you're like, oh yeah, I'm still in Star Wars sometimes. You forget a little bit, just it's so different.
Totally. Yeah. Also, as a side note, before I get into the next honorable mention here, I do think Dagon Locke is the most interesting character for a lot of ways, for a lot of reasons in this book. And I think I don't know, but it seems like the writers are sort of hinting at that the reason the Jedi Order was started, like, a few hundred years later, is because the dark side is so hard to contain. So they almost like gave up on this concept of balance and were like, no, we can't have any dark side whatsoever, because it's so, like, so many people, especially during war and like traumatic events and stuff, they become so tainted by the dark side, you know, and it's so you have to commit to be fully dark on the light side. On the light side
to counter the
you can't have balance. Like it's a, I think that's kind of where the Jedi Order almost started. And I don't necessarily blame them. Okay, the next honorable mention is Tasha Ryo, and she's a Twi'lek female. She's the niece of Hawk Ryo. And the Ryo clan in the Tython system, they're actually like a notable family as well. Most of them are like Force adepts. And they're all involved in the Despot War. And just as a side note as well, the Despot War is sort of it sort of sets the stage for the culture of the Tython system, because it was this huge like internal civil war that occurred, and that's kind of how like a lot of these characters came to prominence, and especially guys like Dagon Locke and Hawk Ryo. Because it was through this Despot War. It was basically like on one of the planets, I can't remember what it was called, but it was this Twi'lek warlord. She became super powerful and caused a civil war. Anyways, Tasha Ryo, she became a Jedi seer, and she would activate the Tho'Yor, which would turn the tide of the war, though it would cost her life. And so the Tho'Yor are like these ships.
Giant pyramids.
Yeah, giant pyramid type ships.
They collected species from all across the galaxy and seeded them all into Tython.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how Tython is like such a multicultural system, is because there was, we'll call it a caravan of migrants, bringing them all to the Tython system. But really it was like collecting, I believe, people adapted to in the Force and bringing them to the Tython system. And Tython itself was just so rich in the Force, like uniquely rich in the Force. Yeah. Right, so it's and the Tho'Yor is like, you know, like what the Rakata Infinite Empire is to Knights of the Old Republic is what the Tho'Yor is to the Rakata Infinite. Like, it's very old. We don't know if it's hundreds of thousands of years old or millions of years old. There's no mention of where the species or who built them. There was a species, the Kwa, that had like used them and built infinity gates, but even the Kwa didn't know
where
the Tho'Yor came from. They just know that there's like, you can sense the Force off of them, right? So
So they'd show up on these random planets. You have very primitive societies, and then, you know, you being a Force sensitive are just like drawn to it. And you board it, and then it just takes off and takes you to Tython.
Yeah, it's super. I kind of love it though. Like, it's so mysterious.
Very mysterious.
You know, and you have so many questions about what it is. Okay, the next major character was Tuul Kahr. And he was one of the major villains. He's a Rakatan praetor and master of Zesh, and led the initial invasion on Tython, though he would meet his demise there as well. And he's one of the primary
antagonists,
at least in the first half. But he
dies off pretty quick.
Yeah, he dies off probably halfway through, if I remember correctly. You want to read the next one here?
Yeah. Next up is Skel Nas, the other Rakatan praetor, who continues the siege of Tython after the death of Tuul Kahr, but like Tuul Kahr, would be killed by Zesh.
Yeah, and Skel Nas is actually interesting because he's very like Machiavellian, and he's also very depraved from what I've read about him. And he really is willing to go to any length to see his power, and is kind of sadistic. The thing about the Rakata as well is, for some reason, this particular species is like very what do you call it? They're very vulnerable to the dark side. Unlike other species, it's very hard for them not to give themselves to the dark side. So the entire species is almost exclusively dark side users. Like, I don't think there is any
light side using.
Yeah. And light side. And it does seem that the Rakata, prior to their discovery of the Force, and a little bit of, we'll do an episode on them later, but a little bit about their history. They were sort of introduced to the Force by this species I mentioned before, the Kwa. But when the Kwa discovered them, they were very primitive and they're very barbaric and like engaged in cannibalism and, you know, like a very, very much like a warrior society. And so they're very, very vicious. And they just, I think the species just hadn't like advanced enough to become more enlightened when they were found. And so when they were introduced to the Force and all this new technology, they just completely perverted it, right? And became a very violent species. And
now are super powered.
Yeah, and were very bent on like conquering the galaxy and had like delusions of grandeur, right?
Yeah, and from the Kwa's perspective, like, not to get too far into the Rakatan and the Kwa, but like probably thinking they're like bestowing them a gift that will elevate them, and maybe they'll leave behind their violent ways if they just learned about the connectedness of all life.
Very
naive.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing is like the Rakata are actually, it seems the way they're presented is they're like totally depraved, you know, like they're irredeemable. They're like a completely irredeemable species.
Yeah, they're almost like orcs.
They almost need to be nuked back to the Stone Age.
Which, it's like, incidentally, is what happens.
Yeah, exactly. they're almost, you know, you're doing the galaxy a favor if you rid it of this scourge. You know, they're just. And I think they would even make characters like Palpatine a little queasy with some of their practices. They really were just completely debased. So, anyways,
let's talk about the Jedi ranks.
The Jedi ranks. Again, you kind of see this as foreshadowing the Jedi ranks in a lot of ways, but there are some differences. and you got to remember that this is like kind of a history, a pre-Jedi history, and the lineage of where the Jedi come from. It's the Jedi-y. So like the Jedi, they had a Padawan and, you know, usually children, sometimes even teenagers.
Young adults can be Padawans.
Yeah, in the Jedi, they weren't as strict as the Jedi were about their Padawans.
Again, being the inception of the Jedi, they're not as,
Yeah, exactly. The next rank was a journeyer. So when you advance from like the rank of Padawan, they would... you would have to basically go on a pilgrimage to all the 9 temples of the Tython, of the planet of Tython. Allegedly it's actually a pretty dangerous journey.
Yeah, it's like arduous. Like yeah. You're going through all kinds of terrain to get to each temple.
And like the Force storms and also the creatures that like live in these caves. Yeah. It's actually quite dangerous. So it is quite a trial. But it almost reminds me of like Mormons or something who have to do their 2-year mission, you know. There's this like initiation mission they have to go through.
I was thinking more like a pilgrimage to Mecca, but
it's similar. There's sort of those religious overtones to it, right? That it's, you're doing a pilgrimage.
A lot of like, I mean, vision quests, a lot of religions.
Yeah, exactly. But once you complete your journey, the great journey, they call it, you then get promoted to the rank of ranger, and you carry out tasks for the Jedi order. You're kind of the face of the Jedi, the public face of the Jedi to other planets in the system. And also remember the Jedi order, it's like, it's such a much smaller scale than the Jedi.
Yeah, they're not intergalactic because there's no intergalactic travel.
It's interplanetary only. It's one single system with a few planets. And And so, I mean, there's like billions of people on these planets, right?
Yeah, but they still have full functioning societies.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're very isolated from everywhere else.
Yeah, so. It's not like they're gallivanting around the galaxy, right? Yeah. But anyways, they would be very similar. A ranger would be very similar to like a Jedi Knight.
Yeah, just completing missions, peacekeeping, whatever the order needs you to do. You kind of go and quest.
Exactly. The next rank was a Jedi-E master. A Jedi-E would begin focusing on discipline, say science, alchemy, healing, or the arts. And if they became skilled and prolific enough in a particular discipline, they would then be promoted to master. So that's kind of not everyone would become a master, obviously. Like a lot of people would just stay in the ranger rank, but if you masters were like very highly specialized in their field of expertise, right? So
yeah, and another interesting kind of observation on that is like, and departure from the Jedi Order is like, yeah, like science, you can be like a scientist and like that's your focus and that makes you a master, rather than like mastering just the Force, like
right?
You actually have a specialization.
Yeah, and that was a big thing. Also, every one of the temples, which by the way had like either a Tho'yor under it or floating above it, just mysteriously, and
it just sits
but there. They were seen as like holy sites. Right?
Yeah, these things dropped us off here.
Yeah,
they obviously mean something.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Tho'yor each temple was sort of like known as a center for science or a center for healing or
each temple would have its own specialization.
Yeah, exactly. And that brings us to the final rank, which is temple master. So that unlike the Jedi Order, there isn't like a grand master.
A singular person.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it's like a council of temple masters, which is one for each temple. So and it's like a lifetime appointment, right? And once you die, then a new
master will
temple master is selected. But and again, they would have the skill corresponding with the temple that they're at, right? So those are the ranks. I thought it was kind of interesting how the structure of the Jedi. Probably the majority of Jedi are just rangers, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the most common. And the people would mostly meet only Jedi rangers because, one, if you're not a Force sensitive, you're not even allowed on the planet Tython. Because of the Force storms, they like you have to have some Force proficiency in order to be able to handle the Force storms. So it's kind of interesting.
Deadly to you, yeah.
Yeah, like if you're not skilled in the Force at all, you're not even allowed on the planet. And so like the Padawans are all training on Tython.
So you'd never meet them.
Yeah, you'd never meet a Padawan, or a journeyer is doing their great journey on the planet. And then the Master is doing all their studying and their...
At the temple.
Yeah, their disciplines at the temple. So really the only...
contact.
The only interaction with the Jedi is with the Rangers, because they're the ones that go out to all the
going
other planets.
Off world.
Yeah. Anyways, onto the Jedi code. Do you want to spit it for me?
Let me lay it down.
Yeah.
There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. There is no fear. There is power. I am the heart of the Force. I am the revealing fire of light. I am the mystery of darkness. In balance with chaos and harmony, immortal in the Force.
Yeah, that's the Jedi code.
And for our listeners that are familiar with the Sith code and the Jedi code.
Yeah, it's sort of combining them.
The two.
Yeah.
I very like subtle.
Yeah. I kind of like it though. Like,
yeah, they made it sound in a way, because you truly do have these very opposing views, the Jedi and the Sith, and even their codes are literally worded to be almost opposite of each other.
Yeah.
And they still managed to make a unified religious text out of, even if it's a, you know, this poem.
Yeah.
it makes sense, and it makes sense for the Jedi, the way they see things and the way things are to them. You are immortal in the Force, right? It might not be your reason for existing like the Sith, but it is a reality of your existence, right?
Yeah. And it is coherent, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think they're like, it's like inconsistent or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, it actually makes sense. They somehow managed to stitch these two opposing views together to be a truly balanced take.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually what I also found kind of interesting about the Jedi is like, so if the Jedi are like Buddhists, the Jedi are like Taoists or Confucianists, where it's where they, you know, like the yin and yang, yeah. Right? Like,
which incidentally is associated with the Tao, which is Zesh's real name. It's so subtle.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Exactly. Which means soul.
Yeah.
Which I think that's probably what
it's Tao's a Taoist concept. Exactly.
Yeah. So
it's almost like they had an influence in real life religion or something.
Yeah, so which I'm actually a big fan of Taoism. I've read the book and some of the writings, and I think it's like just it literally kind of reads almost, some of it's a little wacky, but a lot of it just reads like self-help for like 3000 BC or whatever, you know. So I think maybe I just kind of have like a natural affinity for this story because of that. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. I wanted to get a little more into some of the more, I don't know, interesting history of this, because like it sort of opens the door to like tens of thousands of years even further back. Than before the Force Wars, and before even the Rakata Infinite Empire. And what's interesting, there's a very notice on the Tho Yor, there's a very recognizable insignia on them, which 25,000 years later would be used by Palpatine's Empire. So the Imperial insignia is actually on the Tho Yor. So what is that from, you ask? one of the original Tho Yors that was discovered by this order called the Dai Bendu. And they were monks on a planet. I don't even think they had space travel, these monks. I could be wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong about the Dai Bendu monks. Anyways, this was their original insignia, and I guess they had placed it on one of the Tho Yor, and that's how this Tho Yor has like the Imperial insignia. So why does the Empire 25,000 years later have this insignia? Well, from what I read, is Darth Plagueis the Wise had in his possession a number of ancient Dai Bendu scripts. Scripts, I think it was. And so probably, I'm guessing, whatever influenced him influenced Palpatine. And Palpatine had some sort of knowledge of these Dai Bendu monks and must have, I'm guessing, did this influence him to make this insignia? And like, what was the doctrines that he was, or the symbolism he was trying to get across? You know, I don't know, Christian, are you familiar much with the Imperial insignia?
Not off the top of my head. I just know it bears like striking similarities with the Sigil of the Republic. It just is based on the number of spokes on the
moon. Okay.
And I don't know what their relation is. We'll have to do an episode probably like on symbolism of Star Wars, because there's cool stuff even about like the rebellion and all that.
Okay, so maybe, well, so the Republic had a similar
symbol. Yeah. I think it just has fewer spokes. The Imperial symbol just has fewer spokes. And again, just off the top of my head, I can't remember what their relation is. Like, obviously the Empire coming from the Republic might bear some similar symbolism. But yes, the sigil on the Tho Yor is the Imperial version So I'm not sure how it evolves to the Republic version and then revolves back.
Well, I do know that the Dai, what I did read is that the Dai Bendu somehow influenced the Jedi Order, even like
from
very,
the shadows.
Yeah, even very early on.
Conspiracy.
No, not like that. Just like in terms of
their teachings, their history and stuff.
And again, it's like these Dai Bendu monks, I want to know more about them. But then also Plagius had like these writings of them, these very secret writings of them that influenced him, right? So I don't know. It's just, I find that kind of stuff like super fascinating. Like even in real life, I find that stuff like super ancient stuff that is questions that are like so hard to answer, and there's not really like a good
explanation. Archaeological.
Yeah. Like one era of history I've been fascinated with recently is the Bronze Age collapse.
Yes.
Have you read much about this?
So okay.
I think it's so fascinating, you know, like what happened, the Sea Peoples.
Yeah, the sudden dark age.
Yeah, it's so strange, you know, and so inexplicable. But
like over time, it's similar, like the dark ages are a misnomer. They were called the dark ages because we in the present didn't have a clean view of what happened in that time period. Everything just went dark for whatever reason. Archaeologically, we just didn't have the information.
Okay.
And as of late, people are even hesitant to call it the dark ages anymore because we've discovered so much since then. So by that same like logic, it's presumable to think that like over time we may make discoveries and things about the Bronze Age collapse, which isn't to say it didn't happen. We know this happened, and we know that the Sea Peoples, you know, there's a bunch of theories already floating, and there's awesome documentaries on YouTube and stuff you can look up, you know, about what caused it and why, which all of which like are sound, and I just think over time we will discover more
and not to turn this into a history podcast, but maybe people would be interested in looking this up too. There's also a good podcast that I heard about this on, and then started reading more about it. Was it's just called the falls, or what was it called? I think it's called the Fall of Civilization podcast, and they just go over a whole bunch of civilizations that sort of just disappeared, and they're very hard to
explain. Of which there are many.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Always good to remember when you get too arrogant about your society.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
it's
not
true,
unique.
Right? Yeah, it seems every society has like an expiration date, right? Yeah. And like, yeah, it's good to be aware of that. But there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland. They think it was roughly around the time of the Bronze Age collapse, because actually a couple other civilizations seem to have collapsed near around the same time. And this was like a super volcano eruption.
Okay.
And they think that one of the theories is, and again, it's just a theory, is that the ash like just covered the sky and probably caused famine for quite a few years, and then forced, especially people in northern climates, force them south
to migrate. So,
to migrate south.
Which had these big knock-on effects of like people being displaced,
exactly,
going to war.
And that's one of the suspicions of the Sea Peoples, is why they started invading.
All of a sudden invading.
Yeah, out of nowhere, is because they were probably being for. And a similar story like with the Vikings, even. Like the Vikings just, a lot of the reasons they were like invading the UK and Normandy and all those places is just they didn't have enough food in their own region, right? So like there was a big incentive. Like, you don't agree with that?
I have issues with simpler readings of history. I'm not a historian and I like to take in multiple sources usually. And there are, you know, you have archaeologists like that kind of becomes their pet theory, and they kind of like will do everything to manipulate the evidence to support that theory.
Sure. But if you think like pre-modern technology in a northern climate, and if your population starts growing to a certain extent, you know that there's going to be like huge food insecurity, and that's going to, like,
and I'm not denying that those are triggers for conflict, but there, you always got to consider too, like, cultural context, right? Like, you have a pillaging society, like, pillaging is a pillar of Viking society, right? And same with the sea peoples, like, they were already warlike.
Yeah.
This wasn't an accident. Like, typically you're not going to take a farmer, starve him, and then arm him with weapons, and suddenly he's a warrior culture, right?
No,
now,
yeah.
Now, could
that be
the foundations for one? Absolutely.
But, no, but like, the sea peoples were, like, similar to Vikings.
Yeah, they were seafaring. Yeah. They, like, came, they started raiding out of nowhere. Yeah. Like, these very established, like, the Egyptians, like, very
but that was, like, the kind powerful. Of the, yeah, the point I was kind of making is, like, they are similar to Vikings. However, there is some evidence that the Egyptians had actually some contact with these people. And it was, like, it wasn't all, like, violent. It, some of it, they even had some trade relationships with them, and they had names for them. I can't remember. They're, like, really hard to pronounce, but allegedly for a few years this happened, but then I don't know, like, what happened. Like, it ended up breaking down and went violent, and
and that's the other thing, is how much we don't know. For all the artifacts that we can recover, how much are we missing?
Yeah, it's
so that's it, my other caveat.
It's so cloudy, the history of it, right? Like, all of it is kind of like, this is our best guess.
Yeah, from the fragments we've recovered, like, we're kind of assembling a theory, but, like, another fragment we discover in 10 years could totally upend it, right?
Yeah. So. But to me, like, I find that so fascinating. And if you're, like, a fiction writer or something, right?
Yeah, that there's so much a perfect material. Hole for you to fill. Exactly. Chariots of the Gods, for example.
Yeah.
Which I absolutely abhor, but it's fun fiction.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't go much farther than that with it.
Fair enough. But, you know, and swinging back around to Star Wars, you know, like, there's a lot of interesting, like, not very heavily explained histories and events that you could definitely write tons of stuff inside of, you know. So I think that's what I like most about sort of going this far back in the Star Wars universe and sort of wondering what it was like before everything that we know now.
Yeah. So absolutely. And just, like, a real world kind of point on the Dai Bendu monks, and I'm sure we've mentioned this before, but, like, in real life, that was Lucas's whole shtick for Star Wars, was that, like, Star Wars was a story that was in these Dai Bendu scrolls, and, like, so this order of monks were writing down this ancient history, and, like, through our discovery of those scrolls, we know the story of Star Wars.
Right.
So it's kind of cool how it has that real life kind of explanation. Lucas dropped that idea altogether, but all these other artists and, like, novelists picked it up again. Yeah. And this happens a lot, right? Yeah. They'll take a discarded Lucas idea. Yeah. And then just, like, totally take it. And again, Tython is getting some more love in The Mandalorian. We visit Tython now. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. So, though it may not be the same, like, it's cool to see people like Dave Filoni who know the history of Star Wars.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Trying to resurrect these cool concepts. Kind of cool, funny thing on the terms Ashla for the light. Well, it's not really funny, but it's just interesting. Is there's a Jedi, not a Twi'lek, forget the species. Ahsoka's species.
Oh yeah, I don't know what her species is.
Like, on the tip of my tongue. Anyways, there's one prominent one named in the Knights of the Old Republic RPG MMO. Who is named Ashla Light, which is just a cool, like, through line that they're, you know, reusing that.
Right.
And then there's another Targutan. Targutan.
Okay, yeah.
Targuta? I don't know how to pronounce it, but you know what I'm saying. If you're you know what a species. And then there's another little girl who appears in Attack of the Clones when all the little younglings are, like, with Yoda. And she's a Torguta. And she's named Ashla, too.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, okay. That's cool. People thought it was Ahsoka, but
they've definitively
kiboshed that that theory. But, yeah, and they called Ahsoka Ashla in development. While they were developing it too. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I don't know if that was always the intent, like, she was always going to be Ashla, and then they just changed it last minute, or
See, I love that. Like, even if you're looking at like an anthropological perspective,
yeah.
If you trace a word far back enough, it probably had some religious connotations.
Significance. And that, like, how many of our names are religiously?
Exactly. Oriented?
My name is very religious, obviously. but yeah, so that's a cool through line that kind of just developed naturally in the course of all these different authors and stuff writing it.
Yeah.
And the other kind of, this one is funny, but Bogan being the dark side for all our Australian and New Zealand listeners. Bogans are kind of like, I'm not an expert in any means on Australian and New Zealand culture, but they know what I mean. They're like, it's almost like trailer trash. Like, yeah, if you're a Bogan and.
Okay, I didn't even know that.
It's like lower class, like
I think
there's a personality type associated with being called a Bogan, and it's not good. It's not flattering. I don't know if that was intentional
or not on the authors. Explicit word.
No, it's not. It's not.
Maybe they're more.
It's more class,
Bogan,
like,
or I don't know, but
yeah, you've never heard anyone in Australian.
I haven't heard
Bogan?
That term. No, yeah. First time.
Yeah, like I said, it's more class based than anything else.
Okay,
so. But it's for all our listeners there, we didn't miss it.
For all our Aussies out there.
Yeah, and again, I don't know if any of the authors of the comic were maybe New Zealander or Australian that maybe slipped it in there. But
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, on that note, let's fly out of here.
All right.
Peace.